with episode 518 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville. And, yes, I've always wondered if there might have been something worse than Ewoks.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and, you know, as we celebrate holidays, let's not forget about Life Day.
And this is Bronson from Australia, and I'm just waiting for the TV episode where Samuel L. Jackson teams up Santa Claus, and Santa Claus to help fight someone. Doesn't really matter.
well, at least we weren't celebrating Life Day in the Doctor Who Christmas special. I'll just put it that way. No B. Arthur singing in that particular production. All right, well, we are going to be wrapping up the week's content here with quite a few oddities, not the least of which are some of the things that we were referencing here in the open. But first, before we go any further than that, Edmund, if you don't mind.
When we talk about these things, we like to talk about just about anything that might have happened, even if you've been trying to wash them from your brain. So you will be horribly spoiled, although in this case, I think we might have been.
Yeah, we might have been. Spoiled may not be the right word in this case. But at any rate, we're going to go ahead then and talk about some of these other shows, like I said, that are on the list. And Bronstom, you weren't really able to talk about Homeland or Covert Affairs last time, so I'm going to let you have the floor. Which of these three remaining shows would you like to talk about the most?
Well, I should probably pick one of the two I've actually seen. So let's go with Doctor Who.
Sounds good to me, and let's go ahead and run the promo.
I'm back. I've been inside the tops.
Come on, it's Christmas, the North Pole. Who are you going to call?
What seems to be the problem?
Doctor Who. Christmas Day at 6:15 on BBC One.
All right, and if you could do the recap, please.
Not a worry. Doctor Who, Series 8, Episode 13, Last Christmas. The Doctor, Clara, and Santa Claus go on a dangerous sleigh ride through space and time.
Uh-huh, okay. And this one was... I thought that really this was going to wind up being the contender for the top spot, but Covert Affairs edged it out. This one, I believe, came in at a 7.75, so certainly not the worst episode of Doctor Who this season, but perhaps a little bit lower than what we've come to expect for the Christmas specials. Of course, I'm remembering back to the one with the Christmas Carol, and nothing's really going to... hit that, those
yeah, Christmas Carol set a very high bar.
Yes, it did. All right, but even so, this is the first one with Peter Capaldi. And Bronstone, why don't you go ahead and get us started off, what your thoughts were on this one. I think that you had, oddly enough, the lowest score.
Yeah, I kept going back and forth because while I definitely liked it, I thought that there was a bit of a muddling going on. I feel like I'm going to describe a lot of this episode in much the same way I described a lot of Ascension when we talked about that. But there were two good ideas, and I don't think they blended together quite as well as they could have. For me, that was the sticking point. I liked so many little individual things about the episode. It wasn't a better than the sum of its parts kind of thing, I guess. I really loved Nick Frost's Santa Claus and the dynamic with the elves. Like it was very much one of those where they've given the guest actor the direction. Okay, play him like the Doctor, because there was a lot of that coming off Santa Claus, which is extremely appropriate.
Really, because the way that I took it was is that they told him to do your best Ricky Gervais impression. Some of those line readings were practically right out of the Gervais playbook, but anyway.
I guess I didn't quite get that. But I really enjoyed that portrayal. I thought the idea of the facehugger dream-inducing things, that was interesting. It provided a really great way to bring Danny back for a bit, but I think they maybe nested it one too many times to the point where by the third or fourth time, it's like we're a bit over the idea of revealing, hey, we're still in a dream. And, it lost surprise. It lost impact. Especially that very last reveal, which should have had, it should have been a shock. It should have been a moment of sadness. And instead we're just totally waiting for the shoe to drop. And when it does, we're not that surprised. I don't think it was the fault of the actors. Capaldi's great dynamic, great chemistry. They did their absolute best with that scene where we really think that the Doctor has come back too late to bring Clara along on any, you know, on any further TARDIS shenanigans and stuff like that. Even though I think they played the lead up to that fairly well, just the idea that we find out, you know, there's the one of them in the sleigh that's going on about how, hey, we should totally meet up and you know, try and remain friends or something like that, and just sort of giving you the impression that, like, this is someone who wants to keep this going because they don't have anything going on in their real life that they particularly want to get back to. And the idea of Clara as, like, doing a more subtle version of that, I thought that bit played well. But, yeah, there were just one too many beats in the episode that should have been very strong, very solid, and weren't so much.
It's interesting that you say that it had one too many layers. I actually agree with that. That was one of my thoughts, was that, you know, they broke that unwritten rule where you're only supposed to hit things so many times before, and usually it's three, before it's overdoing it. I think instead of having three layers, they had four, which was, you know, kind of where that thought came from. But I'm wondering how much of that was them playing a little bit coy because they weren't sure of what was going on with Jenna Coleman. They could have easily left out that last layer if she was actually leaving the show and had the episode largely intact without, you know, while serving the need of explaining where the companion was going.
Yeah, there was a you could see the get out of jail card kind of written in there, and just as much in the very, very short, sudden it's okay, she's coming back next series version of the resolution.
Now, Edmund, you gave this the highest score out of us. What were your thoughts on all of that?
I guess for me, I mean, this whole thing of, after having been told from the beginning of the season that she was leaving, and then to have that that kind of pulled out from under us, what I was feeling like throughout this, I mean, obviously not knowing how it was going to end, but and then it kind of got confirmed, but by the revelation that she was going to stick around, was I really felt this was the episode where Capaldi was really coming into his own, and in terms of his sort of the way he would be snapping at people, and sort of that more acerbic side to the personality. I felt this was the time when it was really being given a chance to shine. In terms of the interplay between him and Clara, as Bronson was just saying, was really on form. Having not been aware that there was this possibility of her coming back, I mean, I guess for me, that final layer did come as a bit of a shock. It certainly seemed like the elderly Clara, what was them doing their swan song tour, sort of the combination of that and the ability to bring Danny back and give that revelation, and, you know, give them that time to work through the grief, and also have Clara and the Doctor actually, you know, to discover their, you know, the reality behind their little O. Henry moment from the end of the regular series. All of those elements really worked for me. Even though it was all happening so suddenly, I mean, I was kind of taken aback immediately after the show ended. Sort of as it sunk in, I just wound up feeling very happy about the events that transpired, and certainly for a Christmas special, I think that's a very good place to be. So, you know, yeah, maybe sort of that, you know, I was giving them a little more benefit of the doubt than maybe I should have, but that's the goodwill of the season for you,
I suppose. So, Gary, how about you?
I have to say, this is the first time a Doctor Who Christmas special has let me down in a long time. Usually, I almost view these things as, in some ways, as emotional porn. They usually, you know, really touch me, and, you know, I feel very emotional after seeing these. They usually, you know, hit some sort of chord in me. Until this year, nothing. I felt very much almost like a regular episode. I felt the cop out as far as having a Jenna Coleman go ahead and sort of come back into the series, even though we were expecting her to leave. And honestly, this episode was written with the purpose of her leaving. To do the switch at the last minute really felt like we were cheated. That if they knew that, they would have written it differently to begin with. I concur, without trying to sound too recursive, about the problem with all the layers of the falseness, as well as trying to figure out how the Doctor and managed to connect with everybody else. If everyone else was in different places, yet they still all managed to get the crawlers on them. It seemed rather confusing in that they were stretching to sort of build this all together. So, again, I was just disappointed. As I look at my score, I think perhaps I went to even higher than I should have now that I'm talking about the show. I think of several of the other shows in the past, and they were just, very emotional tear jerkers, pull at your heart. This one really didn't do it for me at all. And I've come to expect a little more emotion out of a Christmas episode, where this really could have fit into any part of the season without and not being called Christmas, or had Santa be something else and still work perfectly well. It wasn't like an endemic Christmas to this episode, I felt.
Okay. Let's see. Anything else that we want to say about this one?
I would reiterate my appreciation for Nick Frost's performance.
Yeah.
Okay. And guys, Edmund, Gary, what did you think of Nick Frost's performance as Santa Claus?
Oh, I loved him. No, I mean, I know I sort of went on about the Doctor and Clara stuff, but no, I really enjoyed that, and if they feel like bringing him back, I would have no problem with that.
I enjoyed his performance. I just didn't think it needed to be a Santa Claus. He could have been this this wisecracking type of character without the cap.
I was also kind of surprised. I thought he looked a real. Maybe my memory's a little fuzzy. He looked a real dead ringer for the Richard Attenborough Santa Claus from that movie. Maybe it was just me, but like that he had the face and the style of beard and everything that it just they I don't know. Maybe that's just me.
Interesting. I kind of see what you're talking about, actually. In terms of it is reminiscent. I wonder if that was purposeful or not. Let's see then. We're going to go ahead and move on to a different topic. And Gary, why don't you pick our next one here?
Well, let's go ahead and talk about my teaser at the beginning. Let's revisit, or visit for some people, the Star Wars Holiday Christmas special from, I believe it was 1978.
Oh boy, here we go. All right, let's run something.
There's a promo?
Hey, CBS. What's coming on?
On Friday night, blast off to a galaxy far, far away. It's the Star Wars Holiday Special, starring all your Star Wars favorites. Will Chewbacca get home to his planet in time for the big Wookiee holiday celebration? Find out on the star-studded Star Wars Holiday Special, Friday at 8, 7, Central and Mountain.
You're on.
This is CBS.
All right, Gary, it's all yours.
Absolutely. We're talking about the Star Wars Holiday Christmas Special. Chewbacca and Han Solo try to get home to Chewie's family to celebrate Life Day, which includes various forms of entertainment and frivolity.
Frivolity. Okay.
It was somewhere back in the 70s, John. Trust me.
Yes, it was. Yeah, yeah. All right, well, where do we even start? Gary, give us something.
Let's start with Princess Leia's singing number. Yes. Carrie Fisher agreed to appear in this if she had a chance to sing. She was trying to broaden her options for acting and roles, and she thought that if she could manage to sing in a primetime special, hey, it might open up some things for her. So as terms of her contract, she actually sang in this episode, in this special. As a side note for people who aren't already chuckling over the special that we're even mentioning this, George Lucas has never released this special ever anyplace. There's never been on any DVD, VHS tape, or any other format this been shown. Popular rumor is that all the negatives were purposefully destroyed, and he will never release it.
Yes.
I am curious if Disney will manage to find some now that they've taken over the franchise, but I don't have high hopes because he hated it that much. Go ahead.
I was just going to mention, I believe he's on record and say that if he could, he would take a sledgehammer and smash every copy of it in existence.
He never saw the internet coming, did he?
No.
Not really.
Well, you have to remember, the only copies that currently exist of this is probably, I believe, the same two or three original copies that people managed to tape off live air and have been duplicated and sold at various conventions for the last 30-plus years.
Going back to the Carrie Fisher scene, I believe I read somewhere that she since admitted that she was so high on cocaine when they filmed that she has no memory of it.
Well, I personally think she's trying to just block it out. But yes, I have heard that as well, that yeah, she was rather spaced during the whole performance. Thank you.
Well, it explains a few things. Bronstum, what else can you add to this?
I have thus far managed to resist any temptation to watch the Star Wars Holiday Special. I've heard many things about it. I've heard it likened to how do you describe it? I've heard it likened to texts within the Lovecraftian Cthulhu mythos. In that to watch it is to know the face of madness, and I'm not quite ready to subject myself to that.
Yeah. Yeah, I
don't know, beer in Milwaukee, to quote someone.
Yeah, I will say that I have had a copy for many years, but in preparation for this was the first time that I actually watched it and made it all the way through to the end, although that was helped along greatly by the existence of fast forward button. Well, I should say, you know, it was not skipping scenes, but being able to speed them up so I could still hear what was going on, but they went by much faster than they would have normally. So but I mean, what astonishes me about it is that for a movie that was so revolutionary in terms of the special effects used and sort of, you know, and after Jaws being the movie that really cemented the concept of the summer blockbuster in Hollywood, to then have a TV special that certainly in terms of sets and effects is kind of on the level of Blake 7, but certainly without anything close to the writing that made that made you overlook all of that in Blake 7, combined with what even in 1978 was just extremely tired TV variety tropes of introduce a situation where yes, we can just have these guest stars and musical stars, musical guests just appear on screen. Just because somebody turned on a ancient monitor, it is just this really weird schism of a property that did so much to advance things in one area, just being completely badly served in another.
Well, you say an ancient monitor, which is of course funny because it would be a far future monitor in the myth. Anyway,
yes.
Let's leave that alone. Let's leave that alone. The what gets me is that you say Blake 7. What comes to mind a little bit more is Red Dwarf. If the writers for that went to the nth level of absurdity, they might have approached this.
Yeah.
It just seems like I still don't understand why.
Well, there's a few different reasons. Number one, it's almost hard for us to contemplate now with all the different media outlets we have. But Star Wars, even right after it came out, was such a influential movie and took on such a life in popular culture, even within the first year, that people were clamoring, screaming for, you know, anything they can. Heck, think about the Saturday Night Live skit with Bill Murray singing, coming up with words for the Star Wars theme song. I mean, it was everywhere in popular culture, and so there was such a demand for it that everybody was howling for something, and they didn't want to wait for the next movie, which was still over a year away, and they wanted something to be able to, you know, sell and push. And so, you know, they knocked on his door, and honestly, George didn't have that much money. He didn't make movie money off the movie itself. All he started to make was merchandising, and as many little figures as Kenner sold, he was still not rolling in it after the first movie. It wasn't till Empire that he really, you know, made his fortune, so to speak. So, I mean, he got paid money to do this, and, you know, it was a way, you know, the actors weren't doing anything much either, so they wanted the money as well. It was a way to sort of push them and the brand, so he, in some sense, was for it, but at the same time, he was very hands-off. He had little to do with its script or production, you know, besides a cursory introduction at the beginning of it. So, you know, he can't take all the blame for it so much as permitting it to happen.
Yeah, I guess so.
I know. I'm not saying it's good fare by any means, but you know, it was a little time segment of the, you know, the 70s, and while we, you know, we do want to mock on it, you know, it did introduce one of the more popular Star Wars figures in the form of Boba Fett in a cartoon segment of the episode.
Yeah, that is true.
So, you know, it is the first introduction of that character.
Yeah. I will say that was the one of the few moments when my DVD player did resume normal speed. Was where that cartoon. Although even then, it was much for the nostalgic value of that animation style, which was definitely reminding me of Heavy Metal the movie. So that was some nice memories from that era.
And I would like to put a special mention that Art Carney from Honeymooners fame was also in this show, and he's my particular favorite of this special. He plays a repairman, and it's quite humorous. So that's my favorite little segment of it.
Yeah, this thing, by the way, for people, we're used to specials being an hour. This was a two-hour-long original broadcast, and it only broadcast, like Gary said, in its full form once. So the fact that it's available anywhere on the internet in its full run is fairly amazing.
And usually it has commercials as well when you get your copy, so you get to go and look back to all those old commercials. So that was a lot of fun. But you know, it did have a lot of people. I mean, in it, besides your classic, you know, Star Wars piece or people, had B. Arthur, Art Carney, Diane Carroll, Jefferson Starship played in this, Harvey Korman from Carol Burnett fame not only played a man but also a woman as well. So Paul Gale, who I believe I'm trying to think, who was I think who
trying he to was think. Chewbacca's dad.
Yeah,
Itchy.
As well as our first reference to pornography in the Star Wars universe on a network TV show.
Yeah. So this is. For many reasons, the black sheep of the Star Wars universe. I wonder if this is part of the new canon or not. I'm thinking probably.
Well, you know, it is interesting though. This was our first chance to actually see Kashyyyk in some sense or form, and while we never really did get to see it in the original movies, we did later get to see it in the prequels. And I have to say, I guess technology really advanced under Empire rule. You know, before they were just living in outdoor trees. Now they were actually inside with video screens. So I guess the Empire did well by Kashyyyk as far as living standards go.
I suppose so.
Yes, I know that's a stretch.
for those who are perhaps, let's put it this way. Anyone who wants to really dig at the Phantom Menace needs to take a look at this and think, it could have been so much worse. And on that note, Edmund, please, if you don't mind, what is your choice of our next topic of conversation?
Well,
hey, we gave it a lot of time here.
Oh, yes, yes. More than it deserved.
Well, I think since we are still in a holiday mood, and I don't feel like verging on perhaps cutting a little too close to current news, I think we have at least one episode of The Librarians to talk about.
Yes, indeed. We're a little bit behind on this one, I guess, but we can go ahead and do one here, and let's go ahead and run the promo.
TNT next Sunday.
Christmas is canceled.
Anything can happen.
Santa Claus has disappeared.
When Bruce Campbell is...
Santa Claus?
Why can't I stop stuffing?
What the hell kind of Santa is that?
The Librarians, all new next Sunday at 8 on TNT. And watch anytime on demand.
And while I think we will wind up doing both, but we'll focus most of our time on this one. And Edmund, if you don't mind doing the recap.
Certainly. This is The Librarian, Season 1, Episode 4, and Santa's Midnight Run. The Librarians try to rescue Santa when the Serpent Brotherhood targets him for death.
That's right. And Santa gives this one a 7.75. So Santa's very pleased about it.
Very nice. And
this had the honor of having Bruce Campbell playing Santa in his typical absurdity that he brings to every role, but also, as perhaps denoted by my commentary, referring to himself in the third person in sometimes the most hilarious possible way throughout the episode. I personally feel like this was the thing that saved the episode from being completely mediocre, was his performance. What say you, Edmund?
Yeah, no, that was my basically my take on it as well. You and I were the 7.5s in the group, and certainly that at least a half point, if not a little bit more, was all on Bruce Campbell. I mean, aside from just the joy of seeing him navigate this role, and doing, I thought, of a nice little twist on it in terms of him being more the incarnation of Santa, and that whole thing of certainly for a show that like Warehouse 13 is kind of focusing on different artifacts. Once he loses the hat, he starts channeling some of the other incarnations. Although I don't know how mythologically accurate Odin as Norse Santa Claus is, that was still a lot of fun, and what was bringing back some nice memories of the Almighty Johnsons. Yeah, what was surprising to me was the way they actually managed to use the story to actually bring in some character development and background. Certainly with Rebecca Romijn's character, who we now know is Eve after Christmas Eve. It was a nice mix of a very very fun romp. When you bring Bruce Campbell in and you already have Matt Frewer in the cast as the big bad, having a you just have to put them in the room together to chew the scenery to pieces. So it was a lot of fun.
Harry.
Oh no, I enjoyed this. It was a lot of fun. Although my wife didn't recognize Bruce Campbell at first. I said, "Think Hawaiian shirt," and then she got it right away. So,
I either that or Mai Tai.
Yeah, too many years of burn notice, I suppose. But yeah, it was great to see him on screen, and yeah, he definitely brought his presence to the show, and almost felt like he elevated all the acting a little bit. So that was great. I enjoyed the premise of the embodiment of Santa as through these sort of different religions or belief systems, all still one person, but different aspects. I thought that was a nice way to handle it, and not just have the one generic jolly Santa Claus. I like that he was a Santa Claus without a beard and the red union suit. It was nice to have a twist on the old holiday, but they still did it in a really nice way. So I was happy with it. I particularly enjoyed the scene when they're in the the serpent, golden serpent. That group called the Serpent Brotherhood. They're in one of their treasure rooms, I guess I'll call it, for lack of a better term. And he starts tossing all the priceless artifacts around to delay them. And I thought that was a cute, novel thing. And I wonder if the Serpent Brotherhood's going to rethink bringing these librarian guys into another room like this in the future. Because this is the second one, by my count, they brought them into. So let's see if they bring them into a third. I'm thinking not. So I'm enjoying the, once again, this is a show that I can bring, that my whole family can watch, and I like that. Sometimes shows get too dark where I don't want my younger children to watch that, and these shows often don't last long because the adults want more adultness, it starts to go over the kids' head, and they don't quite enjoy it that much. But this so far has been hitting a nice medium for my family, where all the younger kids and the adults all enjoy watching the show, so I hope they can manage to skirt that line and keep it enjoyable for the whole family. We need some shows like that out there, and there aren't that many of them, it feels.
Yeah, Bronson, what would you say about this episode?
I think it really plays to the strength of the Librarians as a series, which is that it's catching the outlandish premise with more outlandish elements that sort of lurk in the relative background and a fun cast dynamic. Bruce Campbell as Santa Claus is what makes this episode. It's really fun. It's a bit different, and it's just a blast to watch it from start to finish. But he's not the only thing to enjoy about the episode. Otherwise, the series as a whole would be a bit rubbish. And so far, I don't think that's the case.
Now that brings us to the other episode that I guess only the two of us managed to catch. I'll go ahead and do the recap here. The Librarian, Season 1, Episode 5, and the Apple of Discord. Sleeping dragons threaten to awake and cause global destruction, triggering Flynn's return in a bid to find their hidden treasure. This one came in at a 7, so it was a bit lower, although it's only with 2 scores, so it's perhaps not as indicative. But no, I still think that this was weaker than the other episode, and for a few different reasons. You gave it the same score. What were your thoughts on that one? In general, I don't want it to spoil too much for the to our friends here.
The Noah Wiles, I keep forgetting what his name is, but Flynn's presence within the show is just kind of odd. I feel like the show can't decide whether or not it wants him to be a background recurring character, or if they're really, really setting themselves up to snatch him as soon as they can get him out off of Falling Skies.
I was going to say, my thought was that Noah Wiley is their attempt to create an American version of the Doctor, and at least they toned it down a little bit here in this particular episode, but in the premiere, that was the thing that bugged me the most, was just how off-kilter he was. Here he kind of explains why he acts that way in a little bit, but one thing about this, I mean, he at least wasn't as terrible as he was in the first episode, and this had a lot of really nice story elements that kept it going. A few absurdities, which is why it stayed at a 7, and it could have dropped down even a little further if I was being less generous, but good character moments. What really struck me as odd, and you may not know this just watching it, but this is being aired way out of order. This was actually the 9th episode, according to the production order. The previous Santa Claus one was, I believe, the 6th episode in the order. And so they clearly moved episodes around number one, to have the Christmas episode be the weekend right after Christmas, or right before Christmas, rather. But yeah, the fact that they are moving the episodes around the way that they are, I find very interesting.
I would want to investigate.
Try that again.
The episode. I would want to investigate who's decision to move the episode around, because production order is not necessarily meant to be the airing order.
Well, let me put it this way. When you go onto the TNT app to watch the episodes, it actually shows up as episode 1.09.
Okay.
Which is very interesting, because I'm
very interesting.
Why would they do that?
I don't know. The reason it didn't really tweak with me, because I always figured at some point, like, if you're going to have Flynn as a recurring presence within the show, you wouldn't want to, like, you'd want to pepper him through rather than only having him come back at the end, unless this is going to be the only time in the season that he does appear. Although at the same time, when Brandon's talking about, I've helped, you know, put this team together, we're all a lot better and stuff like that, it's like I could see that as being like, well, it's only been a few episodes. Like, maybe that's something that starts to come a bit later. Yeah, that's going to bug me now. Because the two shows that in my head strike me as the biggest influences on the library. Actually, no, I take that back. There's three things that are the biggest influence. The first is Leverage, because I believe John Rogers is the showrunner of this, who was the main guy behind Leverage. It's made in the same place where they made Leverage. You've got at least one of the cast members, and they've captured a lot of that fun vibe that I think made that show work. You've got the Warehouse 13 angle, trying to pick up on the audience that's doesn't have Warehouse 13 to tune into anymore in terms of the concept and stuff like that. But then they're also following up on the original TNT TV movies, which I'm gathering, John, you've not watched.
No, I don't remember them very well at all.
Yeah, they're not brilliant, but yeah, Noah Wiley was the main character in those. Like, it's right. All the flashbacks in the first episode of the show are from the first of the TV movies. And this is almost the show is I don't know, it's a bit more of a spin-off, I guess, in terms of the vibe compared to the original movies. The movies were definitely trying to play up an Indiana Jones kind of thing, like treasure hunter, occult secrets, shadowy bad guys and stuff like that, whereas the show has gone a bit more fantasy. And it's going for an ensemble dynamic, and it's picking up a it's going for more of a Warehouse 13 vibe.
Yeah, yeah, I get that.
And I think that's,
of his character was the more the Indiana Jones, you know, Alan Chamberlain type of way of going. Is it Alan Chamberlain? Yeah. But, you know, the King Solomon's Mind movie.
Richard Chamberlain.
Alan Quartermain. I got them mixed up. But yeah.
Played by Richard Chamberlain.
Yes, exactly. That's what I'm going off. But you can see I cared so much about that movie too that it was. But at any rate, it felt like it was more in that vibe. So his characterization in the pilot threw me off because it felt more like they were playing him far more broadly, I guess you could say. But that being the case, it doesn't matter. It was like, and those were like what, 5 to 10 years ago, so my memory may not be as good as I had hoped as far as recalling those films. But at any rate, just the fact that I don't know, this may be one of those rare shows where airing everything out of order really doesn't matter.
Well, just the reason I brought up Leverage early was because the first season of Leverage had a thing of they aired a lot of episodes out of order, and when you do watch it in the production order, there's much better flow to the because one of the main arcs of that first season of that show was that the team really coming together while the leader has an increasingly dramatic breakdown, and it all plays a little bit better in the production order. So it'll be hard to tell with this show until we've had the first season. But yeah, so far, all things considered, I'm enjoying the show more than the movies. I think having an ensemble dynamic makes for a much better. It just makes the whole thing much better. They're able to play on the dynamics between actors, whereas with the movies, they would basically have to bring in a new. It would just be Noah Wiley and whoever they could get for this one. The sort of. The quasi-urban fantasy things that they brought in this episode were surprising, but I guess sort of once I wrap my head around them, it's just like, okay, if they did something interesting with this, if they played up the idea of what the library is and its place within this setting in ways that the, say Warehouse 13, I don't think ever quite managed to do, then, yeah, I suppose, and I'm willing to bet that a lot of my feelings towards this show stem from the fact that that last season of Warehouse 13 was just awful, god awful, and the Librarians doesn't have a high bar to clear in order to compete.
That's right, what now. I tell my children. It's well, it's better than the last season of Warehouse 13. They're like, yeah, they should use that as a tagline.
That is actually it is coming up, even though it is certainly towards the bottom of our list right now. It's not quite hitting the same bar as a lot of the other shows. It's doing better than Warehouse 13 did by far. Not to mention that it's now within a few hundredths of a point of eclipsing Gotham, and even
again, not hard.
Yeah, but it's even coming close to meeting the same level as Supernatural right now. So yeah, it's getting at least into normal territory versus where Warehouse 13 was. It's actually almost dead average at this point, which is not a bad place for a show like this to be.
And it's still fun. Yeah, that's the only thing is that like they've taken the concept, they've put in a really good ensemble, they've taken good things from those original movies and scrapped other things, and they keep it fun. It reminds me of why I always enjoyed Leverage, because even in the weaker seasons, it had a good ensemble that was having fun.
The only thing still for me is that I feel like Rebecca Romijn's character still needs to get a better grasp of the character. I feel like she's still a little. While the rest of the cast really seems to be falling into their characters well, I feel like she's still not quite hitting the beats as solidly. And that's kind of the weak link right now for me. Everyone else is perfectly fine. Really, really enjoying... I'm now blanking. Christian Kane, that's who it is. His character is coming along really well as Lindy Booth's character. Which actually I think is a better character in my mind than Rebecca Romijn's character is. It has a lot more layers to it.
Yeah, but it's fulfilling a different function within the ensemble.
Yeah, she's like the female version of Gary from Alphas, and that's really making me have some weird thoughts, but okay.
There's no way they could like shift the ensemble to give someone else that role. They need to develop Rebecca Romijn's character, but I definitely think like they've got room and time to do that. I don't think that's an unachievable goal.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, I think we've talked quite a lot about the librarians, but to round out this episode, we have one more show that aired during the last 2 weeks. And let's see. Edmund, why don't we go ahead and give you the honors this time?
Certainly.
Well, first of all, it's Elementary, yes. And let's run a promo.
Okay.
Sorry, I got sidetracked there.
My mind rebels at stagnation. It can be problems, it can be work. I abhor the dull routine of existence.
We will get the person who did this.
He's declaring war on the department.
I might have prevented this.
I was hoping we might have a chance.
Sherlock, right?
You might recall that I'm quite observant.
Tell me, how many more skeletons would come tumbling out of your closet?
All right, now you can do the recap.
Certainly. Once I pull it up again, since it had somehow closed down. But here we go. Elementary, Season 3, Episode 8, End of Watch. Holmes and Watson join the NYPD manhunt for a cop killer. Meanwhile, Sherlock searches for the creator of a recovery bag who is posting personal comments Holmes made in sobriety meetings.
All right, and this one came in at a 7.25, so a bit above average, but still down in that level. And actually, I feel like this third season of Elementary has been kind of wallowing down there,
yeah,
in that area all season long. This is almost right on where the season average has been. So what can you say about that and this episode?
Yeah, I mean, this was a case of where certainly with the what was going on in the episode, where you have, in fact, not one but two cop killings. Aside from it did air a little bit before the recent events in New York City, but certainly once those happened, this episode definitely was getting a little extra resonance that the producers and writers certainly weren't expecting. But in terms of the actual dynamics of the episode itself, it obviously made it much more centered on the police department, and it wound up becoming one of those cases that we keep running into with Elementary, where for me the case itself wound up becoming much too procedural and to the point where I was figuring out what the villain's endgame was long before Holmes and Watson were getting there, which certainly detracted from the impact of the episode. And what did elevate it once again for me was the stuff going on in their personal lives with this brain addict website, which was not specifically identifying him, but was basically publishing all of these quotes from Holmes in his meetings. And the way that affected him in terms of was a case of giving Kitty something to do, and helping in her latching onto this and really wanting to track the guy down, and the scenes with Holmes confronting him and really going into the importance of anonymity in these meetings and how him trying to justify it in terms of Holmes' unusual approach and how valuable it could be for other addicts was certainly for me a very strong part of the episode, and certainly the way it led up to the final scene and shot of Holmes being at a meeting and suddenly feeling inhibited now that he feels like he can't really trust this place that has been the refuge for him. So on that element was strong, but the rest of the episode was again just an example of a case falling short and not being something that you felt Holmes, in my case, really he really should have figured it out far sooner than he did.
This season just really hasn't been hitting its stride for me either. This whole episode seemed a little bit more predictable than I'm used to. I'm not saying I'm a genius and or so stupid that I don't figure it out, but usually I at least have some doubts or so before the episode proceeds, and this one felt like it really, telegraphed what was going to happen much earlier on, like you were saying, Edmund. I'm hoping they turn around this for maybe the next season, or at least before they end this up. But the way this season's been going, I'm not very happy with it. I still say that they've sort of broken the structure of the show too much for me. Are you feeling it, or has it been coming around more for you?
No, I'm still having the same problems I had at the beginning with Kitty's introduction and to my mind, it's still coming down to that they had this very interesting concept of Watson basically becoming certainly more of an equal with Holmes, and not that she'd turn into a rival, but where they'd have to work on this more equal partnership and bringing Kitty in just to be the new Watson and the new acolyte who he can order around. Hasn't really worked for me at all. The development of her character is getting a little bit better, but it's still, to me, just taking away from what could have been a very interesting character developments between Lucy Liu and Johnny Lee Miller, who certainly could continue to be the highlights of the show. If anything, I wouldn't even necessarily mind so much in some of the more procedural elements if they were taking their main characters and actually giving them some room to grow, or more room to grow.
Well, yeah, I mean, I enjoyed that they were putting distance between the characters, but they split them too much.
Yeah, definitely.
It sounds like the season of Elementary got off on the wrong foot, and now they're just having a hard time getting out of where they wrote themselves into.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is a shame, because in terms of the performances and even though we sort of give short shrift to the procedural elements, I mean, certainly the work of Aidan Quinn and the actor who plays Lieutenant Bell, whose name I'm forgetting right now, there is some fine work going on that unfortunately it isn't being given the material that they could really sink their teeth into.
Any last thoughts on this one, Gary?
Just that it was odd time. Well, it wasn't. I shouldn't say odd, but it was poor timing for when this came out, relating to recent events. And I think people had sort of had a bad taste for the whole issue of cop killings and everything, more so than normal, when this episode aired. And it's sort of, I think it put even more of a poor spin on it for me.
I can definitely see that. Well, we are going to go ahead then and look forward to what comes next in the winter section of the season. We've got quite a bit. We have yet again new shows premiering that we'll be talking about next week, notably Agent Carter, which I am looking forward to quite a bit. And by the time that this goes out, it will have already aired. We see that and a few show premieres, too, coming very soon. Anything else that you guys are particularly looking forward to in the next couple months to come?
Of course, when you put me on the spot like that, they are fleeing from my brain, but certainly I am very much looking forward to this week finally getting back to the Person of Interest trilogy that they really should have been airing just 3 weeks in a row in January.
I won't disagree with you there. How about you, Gary? Anything in particular?
Well, no, it's more offline. I'm glad to finish the Game of Thrones series, so I'm burning through new novels. I just finished the Cold Equation series, so I'm from a Star Trek series. So it's nice to actually be able to read a book in less than a month.
I hear you. I've been reading a few books over the last couple weeks while I've been off, but one that I really enjoyed, and the second book is coming out very soon, is Red Rising by Pierce Brown. It's ostensibly YA, but it's definitely older young adult, if that makes any sense. I would say late teens. It's very violent. But it's a very well-constructed universe. The writing style is very unique. And I will say that you would think that there is a predictable ending to the book. It doesn't end where you think it does, and then I'm a good chunk into the beginning of the second book, which comes out is already out as of the time this comes out again. It comes out this week, and I have an advanced copy, and I'm into it, and it already has gone in directions I never in a million years would have expected it to. So it's a really well put together story. The second book is Golden Sun, so you can go out and get Red Rising and then get Golden Sun, and I'm sure that once you read the first book, you'll be pounding at the door to get the second one. It's a really good series so far, and it's supposed to be a trilogy, so yeah, just a good recommendation there. All right, I think we're going to wrap it up, and we will resume next time with, like I said, a couple of shows coming back for the winter season.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show,
But there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus under the Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.